stop that filibuster because it's time for Grain of Truth. Please welcome your host, David Innes!
Truth, the show that hacks into the truth account and shares its photos on the web. Your grains of truth today. Military dentists have the rank of drill sergeant. Trains composed entirely out of photons are considered to be light rail. When spandex sticks together, it obeys the principle of lycra attracts lycra. And bar stools are kept in pub toilets. To introduce our panelists for this episode, it's over to the probability distribution, John Franklin.
Thank you very much, David. Now from RMIT University, representing technology, it's John Corrie. From the University of Tasmania, Launceston campus, representing monsters, it's Scott McAteer. From Mac Robertson Girls' School, representing domestic science, it's Anna Renzenbrink. From the Queensland Conservatorium, Griffith University, representing music, it's Matthew Hadgraaff.
The rules of Grain of Truth are simple. I award points to the panellists for their responses to the ridiculously absurd questions, scenarios and topics that I pose. Whoever has the most points wins the coveted Grain of Truth prize, which this week is the Golden Ham, who is currently appearing at the Prince's Theatre. Before we begin the quiz, here's a small challenge for everyone. Can you name the Grain of Truth that connects all four of our panellists' names? That's John, Scott, Anna and Matthew. We'll come back to this at the end of the program, but I will give you a clue. Music. Music is your clue. Yeah. But we'll now begin with round one, which is 90-second TED Talk. Each player must give a short speech on a topic relating to their field in 90 seconds. At the 60-second mark, they'll hear this noise. And at the 90-second mark, they'll hear this noise, at which they must cease and desist. John Corrie, you're first, representing technology, and your topic is 19th century dating apps. John, your time starts now.
Thank you, David. Well, look, much as always, we are obsessed with our own time, and we think that the only innovation that exists has happened in the last 5 years, and before that, nothing. Well, I'm here to basically dispel this and tell you that the dating app originally started in the 19th century. The first dating app was in fact developed by Ada Lovelace, the world's first computer programmer and daughter of the famous wordsmith, Lord Byron. Ada, who was very much in love with Charles Babbage, the creator of the mechanical general purpose computer, or the analytical engine, she would while away her time kind of creating, rather than, you know, algorithms that would calculate values, what she was actually doing was writing kind of lewd and crude love messages to Charles Babbage, so that when he finally finished the analytical engine, he'd be able to run it and find out how much she was kind of into him. Fortunately, he never actually finished the machine, and their relationship kind of went a bit kind of dry after that. Now, other popular apps were, you know, very much as we have sexting, you know, very, very simple apps, apps that can be used by Australian spin bowling champions. We have sextoning. Sextoning is actually when lovers would communicate with each other via pigeons. There's like short little notes, you know, you'd have to keep it brief, and you'd attach it to the pigeon, and off it would go. This was actually invented by Dmitry Antonov in Russia, and it was described in Tolstoy's famous 1,000-page tome, Sex and Feathers, which, believe it or not, is the prequel to War and Peace. And the major plot point in that is when a pigeon is shot down over St. Petersburg, and that message doesn't get through. Very sad. Now, lastly, the last app that I'm going to talk about is very, very much like a Snapchat, the one where you take photographs and, you know. This one was called Peekaboo Photo Etching. So the idea was you would, you know, present yourself in front of the light obscure, and you maybe would kind of do something a little bit kind of risque, like not centering your cravat or slightly raising the hem of your skirt or maybe just putting a whole piano leg in front of the lens or something like that. And then you'd wait an hour for the plate to store the image. Then you would develop it over a day. Then you would attach it to a small monkey, which would ride a greyhound, because they wanted to get there very quickly. At the other end, it would be taken. It would then be opened by the loved one, to which then the monkey would pull out a box of matches and set fire to the picture. Mm. And that was actually how they did Snapchat back in the 19th century. So there, I think I've categorically proven that the dating app was in fact invented in the 19th century. Thank you very much.
I like the fact that the monkey was so dedicated to his job and so well trained that it would set fire as
Yes, it's part of the service.
Whatever happened to monkey butlers and things like that? You know?
I think that's where the origin of the term hacking came from.
Oh,
because
right.
You had to attack the monkey with a knife and intercept someone's pictures.
Those were the days.
When monkeys were in charge of pictures, you know, they weren't leaked. Put it that way. You know? Some things have gotten better and some things have gotten worse.
Maybe leaked on, but no. We've sunk it below here. If you think back into the past or whatever else, and you know, if you think of your experiences of courting or whatever else, what would be an era that you would love to be engaging in courting? See, I part of me, the romantic in me, likes the idea of, you know, dances and balls and things like that, as in the dance balls. Not anyway. The point is, I kind of like that romantic image, a slightly Jane Austen type of image, and well, being rather sad and so forth, but joyous at the same time. Is there an era that you would like to go courting in?
Cavemen.
Cavemen?
It was not subtle. You didn't have to go through all this wasting money on drinks and everything. It was just, come with me, love.
I love the fact that cavemen did sound like some sort of country Victorian.
Queensland.
Come here, love.
Come, love.
Are you saying that northern Queenslanders are cavemen?
Yes.
Very.
I think the frontier brides of the American frontier times, where they were mail order brides, so that was two letters, one letter answering an advert for a wife, the next letter with the train fare. That's it.
It's very efficient.
Yeah. Very efficient.
It's like it's
10 days on the train, mind.
Yeah.
But it's very efficient.
Yeah. It's a great system. Things are better with systems. Next speaker is Scott McAteer, representing Monsters, and your topic is 4 reasons all Australian prime ministers have been reptoids.
Reptoids!
Scott, your time starts now.
Okay, I've only got a short time, and the reptoids will probably try to stop me anyway, so I've got to get through this quickly. Okay, some of you probably don't know about the reptoids. Okay, I'll sum it up for you. 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs supposedly died out. Okay, 250,000 years ago, humans took an evolutionary leap to become basically the people we are today. No one knows why this happened. Some biologists have some theories, but no one knows. Or do they? Yes, they do. Okay, around the same time, 250,000 years ago, is when the Sumerians say that the gods created man. But the Sumerians use the term created to mean gave purpose to. What this means is that some species gave purpose to proto-humanity. Okay, if the dinosaurs didn't die out, even the reptoid-controlled scientific world accepts that they would have developed from the Troodon to some kind of Saurosapien. Could that have happened and the Saurosapiens lived underground to survive the KT explosion? Yes, they could. This is where it comes from. The reptoids are the evolved dinosaurs which meddled with the minds of humans to create the humanity we know now. The proto-humanoids left and went off through the wilderness to become the Bigfoots and the Sasquatches. So, the 4 ways we know that all prime ministers have been reptoids. Number 1, all politicians are reptoids. They're running the world. Humanity is the experiment that escaped the lab. Of course they want to destroy us. I know what you're thinking. Scott, are politicians really trying to destroy us? Surely they wouldn't take away healthcare, take away education, send us to wars. Would they? Yes, they would. Reason 2, you can tell all Australian prime ministers are reptoids. Most of them have been British. All British people are reptoids. There's a legend of Merlin, who when he came to Britain, he found 2 dragons fighting. One red, one rock, one white. He gave them beer and then they had sex. This is usually interpreted as a legend and allegory of the Welsh and the Anglo-Saxon people getting drunk and having sex. But it's really the reptoids celebrating forming the British Empire. Reason three, all Australian prime ministers are reptoids. All Australians are reptoids. The creator god known as the rainbow serpent is one of the truly common myths of the indigenous Australian people, whether it's Borlong, Duncan, Kajura, Namanjara. It's clear that reptoids created this land and its people. Number four reason why you can tell all Australian prime ministers are reptoids. All humans are reptoids. There's a part of the human brain called the reptilian complex. This is the bit of your brain that's responsible for aggression, dominance, territoriality, ritual displays, and doing this with your tongue. This is the part of your brain that was added by the Druidonsauro sapiens. We are all reptoids. The only humans that are non-reptoids are the proto-humanoids that escaped into the wilderness, becoming the Bigfoots and the Sasquatches. And that's the reason all Australian prime ministers are reptoids. Would you vote for a Bigfoot?
I couldn't bear to stop you. I really wanted to get through those 4 points. Now, I was just wondering, we're talking about conspiracy theorists, and I don't know if people, my beloved panel members, have ever been stuck talking to a conspiracy theorist. I have. I don't know if you've ever been stuck talking to someone, a moon landing conspiracy theorist, but the main thing I find about conspiracy theorists when they talk to you is that the only thing they talk to you is their bloody conspiracy theory! And it's very, very irritating. So I'm asking this to the panel, have you ever been stuck in a conversation with someone that you just couldn't get out of? I find conspiracy theorists, one, because I was just maximum Hugh Grant polite. Really? Oh, well, Van Allen bout, you say. Oh, how terribly fascinating. Has anyone been stuck in a conversation they couldn't get out of?
I live on the 86 tram route, so...
Say no more.
Yes. Well, I will, though. this guy told me all about how the Great Wall of China was built to stop a tidal wave, and he knows this because he was a general in the Chinese army. Sans accent.
There we go.
I'd just love to imagine that guy wasn't even Chinese.
Talk about a beardy weedy. Yeah. And he told everyone on the whole tram, pacing up and down, to hold our attention. It was great.
Isn't public transport just wonderful? Yeah, it really is.
I was on a domestic American flight, so there's a higher likelihood of a conspiracy theorist. Mm. And the woman I was sitting next to was thoroughly enjoying 50 Shades of Grey. And needed to talk a little bit about that.
And you literally can't escape that.
Couldn't escape. I was probably willing to talk about the Da Vinci Code more than I was 50 Shades of Grey, which is just saying something.
Yeah, that is saying something. Our next speaker is Anna Renzenbrink, representing Domestic Science, and your topic is catering for long-term guests. Anna, your time starts now.
Great. Well, there have been several high-profile kidnapping cases of late. Teen girls grabbed from the streets and kept in basements, and daughters kept in attics. This, combined with the threat of impending doom and global warming and apocalyptic rapture, means that mastering the art of bunker catering has never been more important. So here are three simple rules to follow when feeding your prisoner or catering for your bunker mates. Nourish, flourish, and punish. First, nourish. Food should be nutritious to keep your guest alive as long as possible. Easy to eat soups and jellies to soothe throats made hoarse from screaming are highly recommended. Mashed potatoes or blancmange, these foods will not hurt when hurled across the room. Think protein shakes or Greek yogurt sprinkled with activated almond meal. Avoid spaghetti as it can be woven together to form a rope. Remember, spoons are okay, forks and knives are weapons. Number two, flourish. Treat such as a Kinder surprise go a long way. Your guest will appreciate the sweet, sweet chocolate and also the fun toy to while away the hours. See also magic gum, pop rocks, marshmallows, melody pops. And on New Year's Eve or birthdays, try dropping a Mentos into a bottle of Coke for some homemade fireworks. And finally, punish.
church.
Inevitably, your guest will misbehave and need putting in her its place. Try highlighting that an omelette was made with free-range eggs. Or load up your long-term visitor's plate with carbs. A packet of Tim Tams will ring on a carb coma. They'll be forced to sleep and hate themselves, making them more compliant. If you want to infuriate your prisoners and really send them a strong message, you know, I'm not to be trifled with, this is a serious situation and I mean business kind of message, the best worst thing you can do is give them all the ingredients to make a recipe out of Jamie Oliver's 30-Minute Meals Cookbook, and only 30 minutes. They'll be screaming in frustration within hours.
Well, there's some handy tips for all of us there. Our final speaker for the first round is Matthew Hemgraff, representing music, and your topic is jazz is just poor form. Matthew, your time starts now.
Thank you. Now, whether you're the professor of musicology at Juilliard, and I mean real musicology, not the Prince kind, or if you're the next contestant coming up on Australia's Got Teenagers, music... music is a demanding bee-hutch. It needs certain standards. You must practice until you're isolated and weird and until you know your thing. But jazz, it's just poor form. Now, I'm not going to pick on individual jazz musicians, but I'm going to pick on a couple of jazz musicians here. Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Monk never bent his fingers to play piano. What's the first thing that a nun whacks into you with a ruler at your first piano lesson? Miles Davis only ever played as few notes as he possibly could. Some may call it minimalism. Let's call a spade here. He was lazy. It was poor form. Dave Brubeck couldn't count. Take five. Take music lessons, Dave Brubeck. Poor form. Now, in general, most jazz musicians never ever bother to use sheet music. All jazz chords are awful, and for all we know, cobbled together right there and then. No jazz singer ever uses or bothers to learn the words. You hear them skiddly-da-ba-ba-ba. What are you, 4 years old? Justin Bieber sucks. It's nothing to do with this, I just can't say it often enough. And finally... jazz musicians make up everything on the spot. Now, what kind of half-assed performer turns up to a gig not preparing anything and just makes it up on the spot? I ask you. Silence in the room. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Matt, you look sensational. Well, yes, that's true. But you're also thinking, the last time you heard jazz, it was good. Well, let me tell you something. No matter what venue it is, it's no accident that they serve alcohol first and jazz second. You're all pissed. I'm sorry to say it, but ladies and gentlemen, jazz, poor form.
I quite like jazz, but I think that's the science teacher in me. You're saying that's poor form, and you are obviously of the music variety, you are. You are musically persuaded. Is there the opposite of that? What would you think is the highest form of music?
Organ playing, and I know this because I'm astonishingly bad at organ playing. If you put a 16-foot stop on, it means that if you fudge a note, not only do you hear it, but you feel it. So a good organist has a brain like an analytical engine.
Right. Oh, yes. Is there a kind of music panel that you feel often chastised about for enjoying? For instance, for me, I have chastised for liking either jazz music or perhaps that weird era of 1980s pop, which was a bit weird, like She Blinded Me with Science, that kind of thing, which is a great song and ridiculous. Have you been ever chastised for your music choices?
I went through a bad electronic phase in the 90s. I'm just putting that out there. But I think we all did that. But can I just throw in, though, that electronic music was invented in Melbourne. And this is my grain of truth for today. So, after World War II, we got some blueprints for computers, and we built a computer in Melbourne. I think it's at the Melbourne Museum. And that was the first computer in the world that they made music on.
Ooh.
Electronic music.
Yeah. I believe that's a... fun fact. There we go. That's some extra points for your fun fact. You. Oh, there we go. John Corrigan, the contact. Well, now it's over to a score update from Mr. Franklin. John, what is? Give us an update on said scores.
Thank you very much, David. At the end of that round, in the lead, we have Anna Renzenbrink with a rope made of woven pasta.
Our next round is the analysis and application round. Our panel is divided into teams of two and must apply their skills to an application task. John and Scott, I'll be challenging you to tell us some medical facts, possibly fun or otherwise, medical facts behind these old wives' tales. So can you please tell me the medical fact behind that you don't wear hats indoors?
Oh yes. Very, very dangerous.
Yep. So what happens?
So, but essentially what happens is if you're indoors, most places have always had some form of heating.
Yep.
And...
But no roofs.
No roofs.
That's them being indoors.
So, you've got a heating source.
Yep.
And you've got no roof. What happens? Hot air rises. It hits the brim of your dashing fedora or top hat. Suddenly it flies up into the air and hits a pigeon.
And then, like, a lover's message doesn't get through. And it's horrible.
That's right. Do you want to be responsible for that, David?
No.
No.
I would never want to stop lover's messaging.
Exactly.
Next is, you shouldn't eat before swimming.
Oh, well, I mean...
You shouldn't basically eat and swim at all.
No.
It's very, very dangerous because what can happen is the food groups can mix up, like those Japanese kind of characters on those television shows, and they become like Megabot. It actually happens inside your stomach.
And literally happens inside your stomach.
It's kind of like, you know, you've got the food pyramid, and it kind of joins to become like mega food, and it takes over your entire body, and you become one of the sea people.
Very true.
There's anything wrong with CP.
No, we're an equal opportunity.
And it's too late.
Good adjustment.
It's too late. The C people are already offended, and they're going on to grainoftruth.com.au to go and lodge their complaint.
Dear Grain of Truth.
Don't make it worse. Don't make it worse. Don't impersonate them. Oh, that's really offensive. Finally, at weddings, you should have something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue. What is the medical fact behind that?
Oh, well, I mean, something old is obvious. You need to have... you can't have a huge shock to your system. So you need the reassurance of something
old. Of a rusty nail.
Yeah, rusty nail. Specifically a rusty nail because of tetanus.
Yes, yeah, because... Which makes you go blue.
Which can exactly, and that's where the something new comes in, doesn't it, John?
Yes, it does, Todd. It does. So this is where new advances in medical science come through.
That's right.
Will cure your tetanus. Because the thing is, it'd be nothing worse on your wedding day to walk up the aisle totally blue, ready to die, without new science and technology to heal you.
And we don't really own that medical science. We're just borrowing it from the rest of the community.
Ladies and gentlemen, John and Scott. Matt, I'll be challenging you to elaborate as to how the following events could be made more extreme. We've heard of extreme versions of events. I want you to tell me what would be the extreme cleaning the house?
Not using gloves.
No.
When you're using bleach.
Whoa.
Not putting the fan on in the bathroom when also using bleach.
Whoa.
Extreme hallucinations.
I'm gonna see that and raise you one, because I'm from Queensland. We have a more industrial approach to extreme sports. So have you ever tried extreme ironing? First you set fire to a steamroller so it gets all good and hot. Then you put it at the top of a hill with your clothes at the bottom and... Oh. You had to be there.
They come up a treat, though.
They do. Nothing starches the collar like a blazing bulldozer.
What would be extreme choir singing?
Oh, man.
Every single church, you will notice, has a robust ceiling of beams that you can hang a trapeze from. The only problem is the tuning when you get the Doppler effect.
And finally, extreme stamp collecting.
It's not dumb because it's illegal, but it's actually about taking other people's mail out of the mailbox, snipping off the stamps before they get to it, and then very carefully putting them in albums.
To get said mail out of other people's things too, you'll know of the dynamite roller skates.
Dynamite roller skates.
Oh my god. Yeah, you start at the top of the street. A Queensland thing again, sorry about this. Set fire to the dynamite, hunch up, and then off you go. You have to kind of grab them as you go past. You had to be there.
It sounds a little inefficient, but excellent. Ladies and gentlemen,
it's extreme!
Fabulous.
Look, that's true. There's an excessive quantity of fabulosa sort of bubbling over here.
Take some yogurt for that.
Yep. Sure.
The fabulosa's gone too far.
That's right. It's extreme fabulosa. And now that's the end of that round, so it's over to John with the scores. John.
Thank you very much, David. At the end of that round, it's Scott and John in the lead with a 7.2 centimetre piece of string.
Yes! There we go. Our next round is one of my favourite rounds of all time, and it's called How Delightful. I'll be giving each pair a topic, and they must list as many delightful things as they can in 60 seconds. If the other team or myself think that what they've just said is not delightful, I'll pass the topic over, and it's a very much a fight to the death. They can make a noise like this.
Ding.
Well, I love the fact that she said it, even though it was quite clearly...
it's the one that went ding.
Yes. But if it's not delightful, I can take over and pass on. Of course, you can ding in if you dare declare that that's too many dings. Only one.
That's more of a ding-a-ling.
There we go. Super. There we go.
Keep it inside.
There we go. You do your internal digging, not external digging. Anyway, I'm just going to move on. But you can take over if you feel need to. We're going to start with John and Scott, and I'll be counting how many delightful things you can say about cake.
Ooh, cake. It has icing. You know what? I love Black Forest cake. Partly because it tastes delicious, partly because it's always a surprise, and partly because it makes me feel like I'm wandering through a dark forest of deliciousness to get to that sort of centre of the forest, which is the jam, which is like the blood of...
We'll have to stop there. We're talking about blood of the forest. That's a little bit awkward. I'm going to throw it back over.
Black Forest cake is delightful. It's because it's a gâteau, which is French, and French cakes are the most delightful of all cakes, are they not?
They definitely are, and back me up on this. The best thing about cakes is 1950s housewife fashion. Glasses.
I'm sorry. We're
polka dots.
I'm sorry. 1950s housewives have no place on Grain of Truth. We've got to move
they
on.
They serve cakes.
I'm sorry. I'm going to throw it back over. Oh, it was that how we're going to play it. We're going to... Well, I'm sorry, you've been groaned, and I believe that, according to the Rule 57 on Greater Truth, a groan can outdo the host, so I think you get the time back. Matthew Hadgraff?
Pastel-coloured icing on cupcakes to match the outfit of the housewife and the ribbon in her hair, and stale cakes because they haven't been eaten by her husband.
Stale cakes, no, that we can't possibly have that. I'm going to throw it over with 13.3 seconds over to John and Scott.
I like the cakes are a vessel for toppings. You can have different toppings. You can have strawberries. You can have kiwi fruit. Hundreds and thousands. Chocolate sprinkles.
Those little silver balls, which were like that film in the 1980s. I can't remember the name of it, where silver balls came out of space.
Oh, that one. The yeah. one. It
was and that's the end of the time! Well, a round of applause for Bill. We're currently on even 4 delightful things each so far, so we're going to move over to Anna and Matthew, and you have to say as many delightful things as you possibly can about cushions. Cushions.
The lining, the little piping around the edge that has the frills. That's the best bit.
A cushion made out of your childhood garments for nostalgia.
And those old curtains, which don't look delightful on the thing, but the minute you turn them into a cushion...
Delightful. Or the cushion you would have on your bed that had a little zipper in the side for you to put your pyjamas in.
And let's not forget those little teddy bear cushions that you can take to bed, because there's nothing less creepy than waking up with your head in a teddy bear.
Sorry. What? We won't be talking about heads in teddy bears.
I said it wasn't creepy.
Rule 58 says that I can only be done once. I am the guardian of the rule book. I'm going to have to throw it back over to the other team.
I like the fact that a cushion is, it's not quite a pillow.
No.
It's a portable, comforting device.
It can support your back in a chair. My dog sometimes fights with the cushions. And then they make up.
I think that's rightfully deserved from Dingbat Becca with another 14.6 seconds.
The inflatable cushion that you put around your neck on a long distance journey.
How good are those?
What's the reason for the interruption?
Because I've seen that with like the Australian flag on it, and I just think that that's not right. Honestly.
That's not delightful.
No, patriotism is apparently not delightful.
Take a point off me, please.
I'll put that in the calculations and go throw with the 7 seconds.
I like the way that you can take a crappy student house and put cushions in it, and it's slightly less crappy.
It's home.
It's like a home.
And that's the end of the round. Round of applause as well. Totaling that score, John and Scott on 8 delightful things, yeah. But it was Anna and Matthew on 10 delightful things! And I'm just going to update the supercomputer and I'll throw it back over to Mr. Franklin, who can furnish us with a points update.
Sure can, David. At the end of that round, it's Matthew Hadgraft in the lead with MCMXVII points.
Whoa! Oh, you're like a copyright year on BBC Productions.
I love the way that the BBC held out. Like, when did they stop doing that, putting the Roman numerals at the bottom of things? Because, like, I used to be...
I think they still do, don't they? I think it does, because the practice started in the mid-70s, and I think it still is.
Didn't it die out with bam, 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 whoop, 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 whoop?
That's Thames Television!
Got me on a technicality.
I don't know what's worse, the able to do the tune or the fact that we knew and we could correct you.
That's outrageous, right?
How could you get that? Because one of them is the BBC, one of them is Count Duckula. It's exactly.
I would have said Metal Mickey, but
get out.
Before we find out who won today's show, it's now time to reveal the answer to the Grain of Truth Connection Challenge. Firstly, did anyone on the panel get what the connection was between the names John, Scott, Anna and Matthew?
Yes, it was a Dutch supergroup called Jams. Yes. They weren't quite as popular as ABBA.
It's pronounced Yums.
Yums. I'm from Queensland. But they had such wonderful songs as Preserve My Heart and Sugar Daddy.
Schalke Fader.
Eurovision?
13? Yeah, Schalke Flader is a great song. You all know how it goes. Schalke Flader, I heard a leopard toilet. Forget the rest.
I remember the hit, You Mama Laid Me So Happy.
Splendid. Anybody else on the panel? No? Well, the obscure connection that I've got, I actually really like that as the connection, but your names are all folk singers.
What?
John Riley is a traditional Irish folk singer who collected the rather gruesome ballad The Well Below the Valley from 150 years of oral tradition. The song is actually often avoided by other folk singers as it implies murder and in some versions, incest. It was the original theme to Game of Thrones, I think. Scott McKenzie, who died age 73 in 2012, wrote the Flower Power Anthem from 1967, San Francisco, open bracket, be sure to wear flowers in your hair, close bracket.
Have to pick you up on a technicality. Yes. John Phillips of the Mamas and Papas wrote that song, but he performed it, and everyone was dirty at John Phillips for doing that in the Mamas and Papas, because they could have had a massive hit for it. Sorry, as you were.
Oh no, the Grain of Truth connection doesn't work.
Oh no, quick.
I need to find another Scott.
Nobody did hear it.
Anna MacDonald is a Scottish folk singer who sings in Gaelic, Scots and English. In 2003 she spent a year studying at Scotland's Gaelic College and has been commissioned to write a song for the anniversary of the Thread Mill Museum in Paisley.
Wow, I'm changing my name.
And Matthew Stillert is playing at the Palm Creek Folk Festival in Queensland. He is described as high-energy, foot-stomping, alternative blues roots music, dynamic and original, vocals with gusto and soul.
Bloody hell, better call Tiger Ed.
But nonetheless, that was the connection that I found for the Grains of Truth there. But that's the end of the program, and it's over to John to declare us, if you will, who is today's winner.
Thank you very much, David. Today's winner of the Golden Ham is Matthew Hadgraaff!
Come on, I already have one, but that's okay. And I already am one, so...
There you go. Just to add to your collection.
All the Daleks on the mantelpiece.
Here we go. That's the end of the program, and I hope you enjoyed it. You can come and see the recording on the first Saturday of the month at 1 p.m. at the Wesleyan. Our website is www.grainoftruth.com.au, and you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/grainoftruthshow, and on Twitter at Grain of Truths. And now it leaves me to thank our panel, John Corrie, Scott McAteer, Anna Rensenbrink, Matthew Hadgraaff, our announcer, John Franklin, our composer, Matthew Hadgraaff, our logo designer, Tom Markovich, our sound restorer, Armin Petit, Damien Sutton, and the Wesleyan. I've been your host, David Innes. Have an absolutely splendid day! This has been a Reptoid production.